Okay, everyone. Hello, and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. This week, my guest is Adam Ballinger, formerly of the Titans or Giants, Hawks, Tigers, 36ers, and Hawks. Adam's a great guy and a great illustrator and cartoonist at Adam Ballinger Art. If you're on Twitter, definitely go and check out his stuff. You can buy all kinds of crazy and cool t-shirts and sport cartoons and designs. Great idea for a gift, Christmas, birthday, wedding anniversary, christening. Probably not a death, but maybe. Definitely check that out. Adam, we have a great chat about everything from his growing up in Indiana through to college, through then his trip over to Australia. I also ask him questions about who's the funniest guy he's ever played with, and also I ask him who's the dirtiest player he's ever played against, and he gives an answer that needs listening to. The answer he gives is not so much the dirtiest player he's ever played against, but certainly a guy who was ahead of his time in sort of roughness or wiliness, if that's a word. We'll jump into the podcast. Just quickly, I want to comment on a few things that are floating around the NBL. Adelaide have made a bunch of moves and signed Deshaun Taylor. And the big thing there is that, you know, they've signed their quota of imports. So they've currently got Ramon Moore, Taylor, and Wiley technically on the books. Wiley's having a pretty good time in Europe, and there is a lot of talk that because he was released from his contract in Adelaide, that he'll be bought out and remain in Europe. Could happen. That's one for Botty. I'll have to have a chat to him about. You know, certainly there's that idea that maybe he'll leave, and then Frolling. So interesting things going on in Adelaide. Josh Boone signed with Illawarra Hawks. We've all seen that. I think that's a pretty good pickup. We're all very surprised he didn't go to Southeast Melbourne Phoenix. I believe there was a bit of a contest between the two of them as to who was going to get him. I'm upset. I thought he made the most sense and was the best value at the Phoenix alongside Ty Wesley, but it'd be interesting to see him in Illawarra. All of a sudden, that Bogut-Boone matchup gets another layer of lack of paint. So it's pretty neat. The big news, though, is in New Zealand, there's talk that Carmelo Anthony is going to sign there. There's talk that LaMelo Ball is going to sign there. And most recently, it's RJ Hampton, the high school prospect, who's projected as sort of a top five guard or even top five overall. I don't think he's that high, but that he has potentially signed. That outcome is going to come to fruition sometimes at the end of the week. I'm recording this Tuesday, 28th of May, in the afternoon. I have to just wait and see on that, but honestly, I think RJ Hampton, I think obviously Carmelo Anthony would have been the best result of the three, but RJ Hampton, not RJ Barrett, RJ Hampton is looks to be a hell of a player. Super young, so probably won't contribute terribly to the NBL. Most young guys seem to struggle. He could be the exception. But the idea of getting a guy who's so willing to forego college for the international experience in the NBL and in New Zealand is really special. And Hopefully he does. He'd be great. I think he'd probably be looking at next stars. So a very interesting prospect there. But coming back to it, this is Adam Ballinger.
Hey, Joseph, how are you?
Hey, doing very well. Long time coming, but we made it in the end.
Yeah, we got there eventually. Kids screwed everything up.
Tell me about it. That's not a problem at all. I didn't distract you. Are you illustrating today or anything?
Oh, yeah, every day. I've got like a million things going. I got too much stuff going. Not enough money coming in, too much stuff going on. But I can do a little work while I talk, just some thinking and stuff like that.
So when you say you got a lot of work going on, so people ask you for illustrations, or you come up with stuff and just put it out there and people buy it? Or?
Yeah, I do a little of both, actually. I charge more if it is a commissioned piece. So if someone comes to me and asks,
right,
you know, can I get this sports star or whoever? I charge a little bit more for that, but then I also do on the side, I'll do some of my own stuff. Yeah. And then but almost all the original art I do, I sell, and then random other jobs that come in, freelance stuff, make a little money from that, t-shirts and stuff like that.
Yeah. What would be the biggest sell? Do people buy mostly the artwork, or they go for like the t-shirts and the wearable sort of stuff?
No, as far as what allows me to do this full time is the commissioned work. So the actual artwork that I'm selling,
right,
is by far the brings in the money. But then, like the t-shirts and the stickers and stuff like that, is just a bit more of a like residual income coming in every month. Yeah.
Oh, neat. Okay. Actually, just quickly, because I had a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, I interviewed a guy by the name of Al Rose, who was a cartoonist for like basketball magazines in the sort of 80s. And he was telling me about caricature and stuff, because I do a bit of drawing myself.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, a little bit. Not as good as your stuff, but, you know, it's all right. What do you do? Do you just draw literally on paper? Like, how do you transfer stuff from paper to your T-shirts? Like, what's your process from a structural point?
Yeah, it's all like trial and error. Like, when I started, it was only about, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago that I started actually putting my stuff out there into the world. I didn't know anything. I knew as much as everybody else when they started. And
you didn't study this in college or anything?
No, not at all.
Oh, wow.
I got an advertising degree, but that was never had any creative side to it.
Okay.
And just figured out, but it was all, I still do everything on paper, pencil, ink, then erase the pencil, ink it again, pigment the lines, and then scan it into the computer. Every now and then I'll color something digitally, or I'll make a couple.
Sure.
Yeah, edits digitally. But now, because with T-shirt wise, like, with direct-to-garment printing, do you know what that is? Like,
yeah, vaguely. I've heard of it.
It's, yeah, you can get, pretty much, you can just, it's just like printing a picture onto a T-shirt, and it looks pretty good. So
you
do that
all in-house, or you sort of draw the picture and go, yeah, I want this on a T-shirt, and you send it to someone?
Nah, see, I do it, I figured out through this website called Threadless, and there's a bunch of different ones that do it now, but it's a website.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. That. In America, that it's just on-demand printing. You got to make a website through them and promote it all yourself. But anything that comes in, they print up and send out, and they do a good job of it.
I have seen them before. I have seen Threadless.
Yeah, but I would rather do it by hand, because it only gives you so many options. But you can only print on the front of the T-shirt. So,
right.
You know, I've been in the process for a long time of doing a website and getting that under control, and
I
can get. Yeah, so once I get that done, then I want to explore some more options of doing my own T-shirts and really kind of, doing some different stuff.
And your kind of cartoon style, did you just come up with that goofing around, or have you kind of read a few books or seen people you like? Or?
Yeah. I've seen a lot, like everything. So I've drawn, you know, my whole life, not until 6, 7 years ago, maybe less, but I really start focusing in and trying to, you know, thinking maybe there's a, just possibly I could do this
full
time. Yeah. Or even make a little bit of money out of it. You know, when I say I had no idea, I mean, like, I had no clue.
Sure.
So I've got, you know, I've got art books, and I've got, you know, I've read a lot of sequential art, like comic book art. And then, you know, just, the people that you kind of follow now through social media and keep up with their art.
Sure.
It just kind of happened organically, but then also, like, you know, the stuff that, like, the big head, like, sports caricature stuff has worked really well for me, like that 80s, late, early 90s, you know, Salem sports lore stuff.
Right. Are you kind of like, I kind of think with drawers, there's kind of sort of a divide. Are you more of a Disney person, or are you more of like a Simpsons, those sort of cartoon animations? Would you put yourself in either of those categories?
Yeah, like lowbrow art. So what got me started really was like graffiti and street art.
Gotcha.
And I remember seeing that and then getting heavily engrossed in that, and then going from there to discovering like lowbrow art, like you know, like Juxtapose magazine. Have you ever heard of that?
I haven't.
Still out. But that type of art, like you know, a lot of artists just kind of doing their own work and going off on their own, and then end up making a career out of it.
Yeah,
so that kind of like lowbrow art, and then from there into, but always like by hand.
Yeah.
By hand is visually is what I kind of.
I was
really like.
I was speaking to Potty Nodge, who you probably know.
Yeah.
And he was saying, I said, "Oh, I'm speaking to Adam Ballinger in the near future. Would you have a question for him?" And he goes, "Yep." And he said, his question was, "Have you created a superhero yet?"
He's big into superheroes. We used to talk quite a bit about. Because he used to read them a lot. And every tie he wears is like Spider-Man or something.
Okay.
But no, I mean, geez, when I first was drawing, I did just for the fun of it. They're all ridiculous. But then since then, no, the kind of ironic part about doing this as a job now is I really don't have any time to do my own stuff anymore.
Right. That's the bother. So not yet.
Yeah. No, not yet. But I'm not counting it out.
Not counting it out. Okay, good. All right. What we'll do is I got a couple of questions. I'm basically just going to go through your time at Michigan State, on to Victoria Giants, and then just sort of team by team, and just kind of like a little bit of chat. What springs to mind? I've got a few questions that'll direct us around, but if you have a good story or anything, by all means, just jump on in.
Okay, no problem.
All right, Adam. So you're from Bluffton, Indiana, is that right?
Yep, that's right.
What's Bluffton, Indiana like? I've never been there before. Like, you see in movies, Indiana, it's like hoops in every driveway. Is that how it was, or was it different?
Not much different, to be honest. Very stereotypical from, like, the small Midwestern town that you'd see in movies and stuff like that. You know, pretty sheltered, mm-hmm. pretty very conservative.
Big basketball town?
Huge basketball. You know, like, our high school basketball was, you know, is the thing there, and ours. The school had less than 500 kids, and the high school basketball games were Friday and Saturday nights, and that's what everybody went and did. So my last couple of years there, we sold out every game, I guess, capacity, and it was about the gym we were in sat about 3,500 people.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, that's a lot. So it's popular. And did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I got four brothers and sisters.
Four brothers. How many brothers? How many sisters?
I've got two brothers and two sisters. I'm the oldest.
Oh, you're the oldest. So did they play as well, I take it?
Yeah, they all played in high school.
Competitive?
Well, they all played all sports, but yeah, everybody played basketball.
And competitive between the brothers?
Yeah, although I was older, so, I got a middle brother who's a few years younger than me, and then my youngest is, I think he's 9 years younger than me.
Oh, right.
So I'm also the tallest. Like, I'm 6'9", and mm-hmm. I think they're both about 6'3".
Okay.
They could never hold a candle to me basketball. They would hate to hear that. I was older. That was the thing.
Is you're very tall, and they're very tall. Are your parents both very tall?
Yeah, my dad's about 6'6". My mom is about 5'8", but
that's tall. That's quite tall.
Big, yeah. Big families, and yeah, lots of hype runs on both sides.
All right, so you're playing at Bluffton, and then you make your way to Michigan State University. How did that happen? Did you get recruited there, or that's a school you liked? Were you heavily recruited out of high school?
Yeah, I was, actually. I mean, locally, like with the Big Ten schools, I, you know, you go to kind of get discovered. I remember the practice I was at, and I was practicing against other guys who had already committed to colleges, like IU. One of the assistants was there, and he saw me, and then from then on, it was kind of, it kind of just picked up. You know, you go on AAU trips and then come back, and you got, like, you know, 50 messages on your phone from coaches all over the country and stuff like that. So, I wanted to go to a Big Ten school, like a big major Division I school. At first, it was going to be Indiana, because I'm from Indiana, and that's where all big white guys go from the state of Indiana. But that was around the time, remember Bob Knight? And,
sure do.
The trouble he was having with choking incident. And that had all come out right then. And they were, so we took some visits and met with Knight and all that stuff.
How was he? What did he present? Was he as fiery in conversation as he is in coaching?
Yes. He did not care if he had, if there were recruits in the crowd. Like, you know, some coaches will tone it down or, you know, try and look like, yeah, this is a fun place to come. Yeah, we have a lot of fun playing basketball here. He didn't care. He was a maniac in front of everybody. So, and, you know, and very intimidating, and, you know, demanded respect. And in the state of Indiana, he was it. So.
And did that appeal to you?
It appeals to me a lot. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you like that idea of having a real kind of like disciplinarian, just balls to the wall type stuff.
Yeah, it didn't deter me in any way. You know, like, you know, you grow up and you have to pick Indiana or Purdue. Those are your two colleges you can pick from, and what basketball, you know, program you like. And to have the chance to then go play is kind of a dream come true. That's a huge deal. And it didn't bother me too much about the way he was. But the program itself was pretty shaky then. That's why.
And so you go to Michigan State. What did you like about them specifically?
Yeah, I took one visit to Michigan State, like an unofficial visit where you go up with your parents and they kind of show you around and meet the players and stuff. And I committed you know, a few days after that. It was just, you could tell they had something brewing there that was special. Coach Izzo, Coach Izzo and his assistants and the players there, and the campus is, it's an unbelievable campus, and just like a, you know, typical college atmosphere. And it was, I made the right choice, but you know, any school you go to, the coaches there are demanding, like very demanding.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, you go from Bob Knight to Tom Izzo, who's, you know, probably not in the Bob Knight standard, but, you know, fiery, demanding, you know, big-time guy. What was he like as a coach, and did you get along? Did he ever chew you out? Because there's that footage of the sort of the Aaron Henry incident where you're kind of in the kid's face. What was your take on that? But actually, we'll go back to my first question. Was he fiery, and did he ever kind of, like, chew you out at all in your playing career?
Oh, very fiery. Oh, yeah. The thing about him is he'd chew anyone out. So if you were the best player on the team and going, you know, you're going to be a lottery pick next year, it didn't matter. You were held to the same standard that the walk-on was, and that the same things were expected of you. So he was and is incredibly fiery and intense. But he, you know, he, any of his players now, or, you know, old players would run through a wall for him. And I think that's what you got to look at. But, you know, his coaching style is, very intense, in your face, and you got to do what's expected.
Because I saw that Aaron Henry thing, and people kind of were like, oh, my God, this is terrible. I was like, if you've played basketball at a good level and that hasn't happened, you probably haven't gone through the right programs.
Yeah. Most coaches would try to hide it, but, you know, he was – you couldn't hide it then. But, yeah, you know, I mean, it can be a bit confronting when you see it like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that doesn't happen every day.
No.
But I guarantee none of the players were surprised. And Aaron Henry, I'm sure, wasn't either.
Or thrown off by it. So you're there at MSU 98 to 2003. So you get that extra year. Were you hurt or you redshirted or something like that? What happened there?
Yeah, my freshman year, I wasn't going to play much anyways. But I broke my leg. Fractured my fibula or something like that.
How'd you do that? In-game or just walking around?
In practice, yeah, hyperextended it. It was my first ever really injury. Hyperextended it, and the fibular head cracked.
It didn't, like, come through the skin or anything gross, did it?
No. It wasn't gruesome. It hurt, but it wasn't gruesome. So I was only out. You had to let that heal, but I was out for a month and a half or so.
Okay.
And it was kind of my choice to redshirt there, so that's why I had that fifth year.
Sure. So then sort of in 2000, you guys go on to win the NCAA championship. That tournament, what's that like for you? So is that your sort of first playing year, or is that your second? 2000.
It was my first playing year, year of eligibility. So, yeah.
So
we went
that
to the Final Four the year before that, and then 2000, we won the whole thing.
And that tournament for you, was that stressful, or were you fun, or any memorable sort of stories from that? What do you recall?
Stress, I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot. I mean, I was... you know, I was kind of along for the ride a little bit. I played about, you know, I had my spots that I went in every single game and the jobs that I needed to do. I played about 8-10 minutes a game, which is pretty good for a freshman on that level of the team. But, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's crazy the amount of attention that's on it for kids. You know, it was in Indianapolis, so that's my home state. You know, a couple of years before, you're watching it and thinking, man, I wonder what it would be like to actually win one of those. And then you're there, which is, it was a roller coaster. But because I was newer and it was my first experience, it wasn't as, feel like as much pressure as, you know, the career as you get older, I think, as a senior and stuff like that. There's much more pressure on you because you're looked at as the leader.
The standout on that team that year is probably Mateen Cleaves, I take it.
Yeah.
What did you ever, when he's sort of like there, and he would have been all of what, 21 or 2?
Yeah.
And has got the eyes of the nation and has to play well and scouts and this and that. Did you ever sort of get a vibe off him that he was, you know, was he enjoying that pressure, or was he kind of nervous, or a bit of both?
With some guys, you get, you would see that they're nervous, or they start feeling the pressure. He was always going 100 miles an hour, and I never once saw him without supreme confidence. That was just in his DNA. He was an incredible leader, worked one of the hardest workers. He was kind of like an extension of Coach Izzo, really. You know, kind of like Draymond Green is mm-hmm. now, and he gets those type of players. He was really the first guy to commit to Coach Izzo and take a chance on him. He was from Flint, Michigan, and they both kind of exuded toughness like at all times.
Because right. I was reading Andrew Gaze's book where he talks about his run with Seton Hall in whatever year, 80s, I suppose. And he just says how incredibly intense the experience is, because it's just you nonstop for the whole tournament. And if you're a top line player, there's big games, and every game comes down to the wire thereabouts. And he said how at times he'd be at the foul line, an opponent would be shooting a foul shot, and he'd be hoping he hits it so that this guy doesn't have to bear that stress or whatever of missing big foul shots. So I'm just wondering, because there's some guys who've just got. Who were just like, yep, everyone's watching, I'm playing, I don't care, I'm going for it. And, it's incredible to watch sometimes.
Yeah, I see that now. And I kind of know now, I don't see a whole lot of their games now. I follow them when they're in the tournament and stuff like that, or if there's a big game on TV. But, I always see it the other way, too. Like, it's great to watch them win, but I never get mad, if they lose or if any team loses, really. Just because the pressure that's on them, and then, the fallout of any loss, winning and losing is life and death at that level. And it's just like, man, a loss is no one's happy, and next day practice is bad, and the media.
And seniors as well, where it's like, we've lost, it's such a sudden conversation. It's just, your whole basketball existence just turns on a dime.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is tough. I mean, in high school, it's kind of the same thing. Yep. Like the guys you've grown up with and played with and best friends, and then all of a sudden, yeah, you never really, you don't want to think about it until it happens, because you don't ever go into a game thinking you're going to lose, and then when it's over, it's kind of hard to comprehend at first.
For you, MSU ends in 2003. Was the NBA draft ever a conversation?
It was until my senior year of basketball. Mm-hmm. I had done really well. Like, I went to the Pete Newell big man camp, and Rick Carlisle was our coach there.
Wow.
He really liked me, and I'd come out of there pretty highly ranked. I think there was a possibility there of, it was a long shot, but
yep.
If I would have had a good senior year, I would have been on radars and maybe got some workouts and stuff like that. But I didn't, and that's what got me here. Thankfully, that got me here out to Australia as my first job.
I think also you had a tough one, because that 2003 is arguably – probably maybe the best draft of all time, certainly in the top two or three.
yeah, if that darn LeBron James on the bench there, maybe it would have
I've just got a couple of names here. LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Bosch, Carmelo, Boris Diaw, Jason Capono, James Jones, Korver, David. Like these are, multiple all-stars. So that's a tough one. If you hadn't missed out that first year, I think 2002 was a little bit easier. But anyway, these things happen. So you finished there. When you finish college and the draft goes, where are you on draft night?
Oh, I was not. I don't even remember.
Don't remember.
It was not. It was. It wasn't even like a.
Wasn't a
possibility. Yeah. So I was. Who knows? Probably at some pub or something. Like that. I don't know.
So then, at that conversation, you finish college. Is there ever a time where you're sort of standing around and you're sort of wondering, like, what am I going to do basketball wise? What am I going to do professional wise? Or was there always kind of something on the table or some momentum?
Because two guys who I played with were already playing here in Australia. Mike Chappelle and mm-hmm. Dave Thomas were already out here. I knew that, even though I had a rough year, I knew that I'd shown enough through my career that I would be able to play somewhere.
Yep.
And I was willing to go anywhere. So I never really considered not playing. It was just a matter of where. So I got an agent, and he had the connections out here. And I got lucky to be able to get onto a team out here. And right when I got the chance, I said yes. I didn't know really where it was, anything about it, or I didn't even know where I was going to get paid, but I just knew they were going to pay me to play some basketball. So that's what I did.
That was I actually got a question. Mike Chappelle is a name that keeps popping up in your basketball journey. When do you first hear the acronym NBL and Victoria Giants? Like, I'm always surprised when I speak to guys, and through college, the NBL is not really a conversation. It's not something that's brought up. Certainly not. It's perhaps your time anyway. When did you first hear about the NBL and the Giants?
When they came back in the summer, they kind of said how much they enjoyed it and how good of a league it was. Mm. So I talked to them a bit. I remember Dave Thomas saying that, it would be a great place for you. Like, the people out there and the way of life really suits, the right kind of person you are. And I was like, yeah, whatever, we'll see. And then yeah, and then you know, cut to 16 years later, I'm still here.
Still here. Yeah. But, oh, no, sorry. Adam, you were saying?
But yeah, like, you're right. Especially as an American kid, America's not very good at looking outside of its own borders at what's going on outside of it. So, no, I never really heard of it.
Yeah, because I had a chat with Rashad Phillips just recently, and I was kind of like, you know, a player like him who was, you know, right on the teeter of going to the NBA and whatever. The NBL is a perfect conversation just because, first of all, speaks English. Nice. Any city you go to is a fine spot. The league is good and, you know, has been up and down, but at times has been very strong and still is. You know, it's something that the NBL's got to be in sort of every college program saying, hey, the NBA is certainly an option. And so is the G League now and a few other places, but, you know, the NBL as well. But anyway, that's a conversation for another day. So you go to the Giants. Was that a decision of like, oh, I want to go to Victoria, Melbourne, or you just was like, there's an offer on the table, they look good, let's go for it?
Yeah. I did not even know, like, you know, I didn't even know where Melbourne was in Australia. Wow. You know, I knew, I didn't have a clue. I just, that was, well, it's still my personality now. It's just like, you know, I just go and do things. I don't really put too much thought into it. But I remember going to some family reunion like days before I was leaving and seeing a map on a wall at like a school of the world. And I was like, oh, I might want to check where Melbourne is. And it's like, oh, it's all the way down there. Okay, well, whatever. And then I was just like, you know, I'm going to go there. I'm going to play basketball. That's what I want to do. And all I got to do is do that well and see where that takes me.
That's awesome. And so that first year you arrive, let's just put yourself back in that mindset. You arrive in Melbourne, presumably a super long flight, a horrible time of the night. You drop bags or you sort of first meet the team. Tell me about that experience where you're like, all right, I'm a player in Australia now.
Yeah, I don't, you know, you meet, you show up and
someone there to greet you?
Yeah. Someone from the office was there to meet me and took me straight to practice. And I didn't have to practice then yet because I had come in, you know, it was preseason. Wasn't an emergency for me to play. And I started playing and practicing the next day, but you meet the guys and, you know, like it's not a culture shock or anything because it is the English speaking and stuff like that. But, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's completely different, but the thing that keeps you kind of sane and not worried is like basketball is the same everywhere. So that was right. Part of it. I just, you know, I get here and start playing. And that's what I was looking forward to.
And, so you play that first year with the Giants, then you transfer to Wollongong. Was that what influenced that decision? Was that just a private decision or monetary? What was that?
Well, monetary. Like Australia, especially back then, definitely wasn't the league to go to try and get rich. Mm-hmm. But the team folded, so it was only their second year.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. Through that era, there was teams coming in out of the league all the time. So the team had folded, and then I didn't have a job, and then it ended up someone getting injured in Wollongong, and I got on, you know, 2 weeks before the season started, they brought me in.
Wow. And what's it like when the team folds? Do they kind of like come, get, guys, crowd around, bad news?
Well, yeah, not for the imports, none, I didn't know. You know. I don't remember how I found out, but. They don't really follow up with imports. Once you're gone, you're gone. But for me, it's a little different because I had met my now wife mm-hmm. a couple months after moving out.
Wow.
Moving out here. So I had fully planned on coming back or she was going to come with me the next place I went.
Right.
So that was, yeah. So we got lucky to then go to Wollongong.
Is she involved in basketball or you just met her?
No, I met her at a lovely drinking establishment on a Sunday afternoon.
Nice.
And just randomly, and then we've been together ever since.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
All right. So with Wollongong, I think that, or 2005, you make the grand final with a very good team, you know? Darnell Mee, Glenn Saville, the now GM of the Hawks, Matt Campbell, and others. But unfortunately, you come up against the Sydney Kings, who are in the process of winning three in a row. What do you remember from that grand final, and was that hard fought, and those Kings, what do you remember?
I remember it well. What I remember is getting beat by 30 points in three straight games, which was, you know, very disappointing. But we did. That was a great team. I, you said, like, that was probably, that was the best team I played on here in the, the NBL. And we had beat the Kings 2 out of 3 times during the season. We could have beat them 3 times. It was all close games. And so we were pretty excited for it. But then I don't know what went wrong. I mean, they kind of went into a zone. I remember that. And it was like, that killed us. Like, we couldn't figure it out.
An actual, like, 2-3 zone.
Yeah. Yeah. We couldn't shoot over it. And then it was over quick. That was disappointing. But that was a good team. You know, Brendan Joyce is the coach, and he's a heck of a coach. So, yeah, at this point.
What do you remember of Sydney Kings coach Brian Gorgian? Like, he's got a reputation for being quite loud, amongst other things. Like, what would you remember him? Was he ever kind of barking at you or anything fun?
No, I kind of always wanted to play for him. He seemed, like intense and demanding, but all his players really liked him, and he, he's a winner. I don't know. No, he never got into it with me or anything like that, but he's kind of like a college coach. Him and Brendan actually were very, very similar coaches, both talented, but both pretty intense guys.
Yeah. And I was about to say, coaching from, like, college to the NBL, is the NBL a little bit more relaxed, or is it still that kind of sort of college, quite militant, I suppose is a word for it, like, real hard training and no let up and stuff like that, or is it a little bit more fun and games?
Oh, no, way more relaxed. Way more relaxed. You can't treat
pros,
your players the same. Yeah, the same way, because guys can leave at any time. They can go. There's other options. And it's just you can only take that for so long. Once you become a professional, like, no one's checking on you to see if you're doing the right thing away from the court. You've got to take care of your own business, and you got to keep yourself in shape and just be professional, because the second you're not and the team isn't doing well, you're gone. You're out of there. So, and no one, there's no backing. Like, no one cares. Once you're gone, you're gone. So, much more onus is on the player to produce.
It sounds like, it's sort of a circle. It just takes care of itself. Cause if you're good and playing well, you're winning and it's no problem. But if you're not taking care of yourself and you don't, you know what the outcome's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
You then move on to Adelaide in 2007-12. What motivated that move?
That was just a bit of a change. Like, they paid me some more money, which was good.
Yep.
But it was just, I don't know, just time to, Wollongong was always up and down, like they still are now, as far as, like, ownership and, management, all that kind of stuff. Just wanted to change, and Adelaide seemed like a good place to go. That Phil Smyth was the coach then, and
what was he like as a coach?
He was great. He was the most relaxed coach I've ever had, and you don't kind of realize the method to his madness until afterwards. Like, sometimes you think, man, he's letting us play and everything like that, but there's not much direction. But then, if you have the right players, like, if he had the right players who can play into that system, like, the sky's the limit. And we, at times, we were really hard to beat because everyone was playing so free and with, like, supreme confidence. Right. He was great at that.
And what did he do? Like, when you say casual, was he casual at trainings and in game? Did he just sort of sit there in games and, like, all right, they're on a bit of an 8-point run.
Never worried. Never worried about anything. He wouldn't yell at you either. The only thing he would do is if he didn't like what you were doing or wasn't happy with it, he just wouldn't say it. He wouldn't talk to you. That was how you knew you were doing something wrong. But, like, as far as we had actions, we didn't have any plays set up. There was just actions on the court, a lot of motion stuff, and everyone was really free to kind of
just thinking and feeling it.
Yeah, play to their strengths. He was really a coach like that can really instill confidence in his players.
Well, I was about to say, so that you're there for 2 years. 2008 is when you really that's probably your best season, I'd say. You finished 4th in MVP. What do you remember about that season in particular? Something clicked? Did your body feel good? Was Phil the coach at that time?
No, he was only the coach for 1 year. I can't remember. I finished 2nd for MVP 1 year. I finished 3rd. Tied for 3rd a couple of times, and then 4th and 5th once too.
What do you remember as being your best year? Or is it all kind of...
So my last year in Wollongong, which was then, I guess, 2006, and then probably the first there was a time there where I won five straight team MVPs. So 1 year Wollongong and four in a row with Adelaide. My best all-around year was with last year in Wollongong. I think I was top 10 in 8 of the 10 positive categories in the league. So top 10, yeah, top 10 or top 5, something like that. Anyways, that was a good year, and that was what got me to Adelaide for the next 4 years. That was really the peak of my career.
And what do you think clicked in that time? Was it just like your age was sinking in well, your body felt good, or was it a system thing, or you know, what happened?
Yeah, age and just kind of everything coming together. You know, confidence and you know, feeling like you deserve to be here, and kind of accepting that this is a league that I want to stay in, and just see how well I can play and how far I can take my career here. And kind of everything coming together.
How big a thing do you think it is for an import? Because I look at guys who obviously import, sometimes they come for a year, maybe two, or come for a year and come back. How big? You just said it before, but how big do you think it is for an import to go, you know, I'm an NBL player, this is my league, I'm going for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's rare, and you can understand why, because family and everything is back home. It's kind of, I think lots of other players would want to do it, but you got to be in the right situation. Like, import job is a tough job. So if the team's not playing well, it's not necessarily your fault, but you're the first guy to go. So it's hard to stay on teams, and it's hard to really make a career because – you know, you're getting cut, and then you got to move to another country and play for another team. As an import, really, you're more of a mercenary. So you just kind of come in and give your year, give your 3 months or whatever's needed, and you kind of got to produce. But I was lucky enough to get on teams that I played well on, and then eventually become a citizen, so I didn't have to worry about that anymore.
Oh, good. And that happened, what year did that happen?
I think by my third year in Adelaide. So
okay, 2010, so when you're maybe still around there. Oh, that way. Have you ever speaking about how, like, in import, you're like a mercenary? I've actually got a copy of this book next to me, Can I Keep My Jersey by Paul Shirley. Have you ever read that?
Oh, yeah, I've read I read most of it.
Yeah, that very much sums up the life. Because, you know, basketball, you think it, you know, comes and goes. But, I mean, his story is very much like just you are just pinballing from team to team, city to city, country to country in some cases. It must be a crazy life being that import. When you're an import on an NBL team, do you feel that pressure, or is there kind of like is there ever a divide, like import and local? What's that relationship like where you are that kind of hired gun?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, you feel it. You don't, in good situations, you don't feel it. If you're on a good team and everybody plays together and you're winning, I mean, in sports, just winning solves all problems. When you're losing, everybody's worried and everybody's looking around. But yeah, you know, kind of what the deal is, and you know that, you know, if you're not playing well, or if the team isn't playing well, you start hearing whispers, and you're starting to worry about, you know, if someone's going to be in your locker when you show up and stuff like that. You know, I was really close in Wollongong. I didn't know until afterwards, but I was one game from being sent home. And then I had a really good game against Sydney. I broke out of a, not slump, like a mini slump. Definitely wasn't my fault. And yeah, I would have been home. I would have been gone. So wow. Things would have been quite a bit different.
It's that much of a teeter on life and death, I guess. It's that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I had like 6 points in the first half, and that was the game. And then in the second half, I think it just broke free finally. I had 33 points in the second half and like 18 rebounds or something, and kept my job.
Do you think, as an import, are you getting everyone's best every night? Are they like Adam Ballinger come in? He's America. I'm, you know. So you're getting everyone's best. Do you think?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, they, you know, they all do scouting reports, and some, especially now, some imports are there just to rebound and play defense. And but yeah, you're going. But a lot of times you're going against another import, so I always took that pretty seriously. Especially if anybody came in with any NBA experience, I always tried to.
Course.
Play extra hard against them.
I was about to say, this season, did you watch much of the NBL this season?
Yeah, a lot of it. Yeah, I've got three kids and two younger boys who
are into it.
Are nothing but basketball, so we watch all the time. Yeah,
because when you were saying about like an import sort of teetering on the brink, the one that springs to mind was a guy in Sydney here, David Ware, who had a very up and down year. I think you'd be the first to admit that, but he had a couple of really big games. Had one in Perth where he had a massive shot to basically win it, And, you know, there was talk that, you know, that was the same thing like you, like he'd have a couple of bad games and there was a bit of a whisper and then he hit that big shot, had a nice game, kind of, I think he actually hit one in New Zealand first and then later on in the year hit one in Perth. So it's like when you say it's a very, you know, you just, you need that one game sometimes to get you through.
Yeah, exactly.
When you bump into other imports, that kind of like, are you kind of like, hey, you know, import, I get it. Is there a bit of a club within a club? You know what I mean?
Oh, a little bit, yeah. I mean, especially if, like, if there's guys who are from around where you are from or, like, played in the same conference in college or you played against them. Or, yeah, a little bit. But then the longer you're out here, the less you kind of not identify with, but you kind of build your own support team out here and your own people. So it's a little bit different. When you first get out here, you're certainly kind of on the lookout for other,
guys,
you know, ties to home. Yeah.
Yeah. In 2010, you signed to play in Israel. What motivated that decision, and how did you find it?
Well, I'd always wanted to. A lot of guys go play in the off season of the NBL somewhere else, and I had a couple opportunities I had passed up, and then I don't know. I just thought I'd like to try it sometime. So the opportunity came up after the NBL season to go out there and play for the, you know, for about 3 months. And it was all right. It was good at first. I really enjoyed that first, but then like the team, you know, we didn't do that well. They weren't paying us. And, we had to play in like, that's the problem. The pay, if you're out there and the pay's not coming in, you're just thinking, you know, you're away from your family, away from kids. Like what am I doing?
It's
here?
An all too
that's
common
when it gets
tale
hard.
As well. Like it's yeah. So common where, you know, you go over there and you're playing and you don't go so well. And all of a sudden the well runs dry. But sorry, you were saying, so you're not doing so well and the money stops. Keep going from there.
Yeah. So, you know, I finished out the year and I didn't get all the money, but I got most of it like months after I already got back. I was glad I did it, but we ended up losing the play down game. It was didn't end up great, but I'm still glad I did it experience wise.
Yeah. And Israel's a place to live and be. Is that a nice place? A nice spot?
Yeah, it is. It was, you know, culturally much different. Good people, very good people. And, I felt, you know, completely safe and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, I didn't travel around as much only because I was on my own. I would have done it more if I knew some other people there. But I went to Tel Aviv quite a bit and stuff like that. So it's pretty neat there.
And the basketball culture, like, are the crowds mad for it?
Yeah, the crowd for us wasn't as big because it was in a smaller town. Mm-hmm. But then you go to other clubs and they were crazy. I mean, like, you know, just like the soccer fans kind of the same. They had chants and all that.
Coins on the floor and sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I never got hit with anything, but there was this place called Cologne or something. And their fans were just mad. Like, it was like in a dome, an old, like, dome. And, that, you know, people were smoking. And they had a whole section that were guys with their shirts off and just screaming at you. And that was probably the toughest place in my whole career. The toughest place I ever played.
Wow.
Some small town in Israel.
Here's my question there. Is like, you go walk into the arena, is it all men in the crowd? Because I find it hard to – you go to an NBL crowd, and it is a lovely smattering of men, women, young, old kids. You know,
yeah, it's family,
like,
yeah.
Whereas you go into a gym like that, is it just all dudes?
At this one particular place, it seemed like it was, but not, you know, all the other places, like, it looked pretty even, yeah.
Pretty even thing. Yeah, because I thought for that to exist, you must just have, you know, just even a young age group, anywhere from sort of, you know, 25 to 40 or whatever, energetic, young, carefree, you know, because I've heard wild stories of crowds. But, I mean, because I remember, you know, growing up in Perth, I mean, Challenge Stadium always had a reputation for being pretty rabid. And I guess it was because it was you would have played there, small arena, crowds that were, you know, into it. Really, really into it. Was that the hardest place to play in Austria?
Probably. At first, I didn't like going there. And then when I was with Adelaide, we had all, even though we struggled some during the season, win loss, we were always played Perth competitive. And we actually had a really good record there on the road. And I didn't like it at first. But then you kind of get to really kind of soak it all in. And I love playing at that Challenge Stadium. Mm-hmm. It was because, you know, I see a red and the fans are like a couple steps away from the baseline.
It was the most intimate sporting experience I've ever been to. I've been to sports in a lot of places, a lot of countries.
it was special. Like, it, you know, the atmosphere and to be able to play there, and like they all kind of, they all know your name and they're all yelling. I mean, you can kind of go two ways with that. You can either hate it or you can embrace it. And I, that was my favorite place to play on the road just because of how intense it was. Mm.
Was there anywhere that didn't blow your skirt up playing? You're like, oh no, we got to go there.
Just the place with the atmosphere is great. Like Brisbane, okay. You know, with, they call it the library because it's so quiet in there. Yeah, but anywhere, like, if you go someplace and you play well on the road and you win, that's, you kind of like it there. But when you're playing bad on the road, every place becomes a nightmare.
My next question, your impression of clubs. Like, so when you think of Perth, like, do you think sort of a bit of a bully of the NBL, well-established, you know, always a good team, always competitive, play that real sort of rough, not rough, but strong sort of style. What do you think about when I say, like, a team like Perth Wildcats?
Yeah, jealousy. It's astounding what they're able to do, you know, and they've been doing it for a long time, not just since the NBL has picked back up, but, you know, they've been selling out the arena and the
20 years.
The culture they built there is, oh, I mean, it's incredible. Like, you know, there should be sporting clubs from all over the world kind of looking into what they're doing and how they do it. Nothing but respect for a place like Perth.
What about someone like Sydney, who at the time you went there, time you played, obviously were very successful, three in a row and whatnot. What do you think about when I say Sydney Kings?
Big market team. So we were at Wollongong, so we were the small market team just down the road. So that was a rivalry for sure. But now, you know, I don't really hold any grudges. But when we were playing, it was a definite rival.
Yeah, neat. And then in Adelaide, when you got to Adelaide, were they kind of like, we have a big rivalry with Perth? Did you bought into that bit?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't like made up. Like, it was real. And Adelaide loved their sports and they loved their teams. And, you know, there's always talk of when they won those championships and stuff like that. I love living in Adelaide. I love being able to play there at the, with the, it's gone, where we played, went through so many different names.
Tatum's Sports Arena.
Yeah.
One, I remember. Yeah. It's been a lot. It's one I plucked out of the sky.
But you know, Adelaide is definitely a smaller market team. You know, sometimes they've been holding on by a string, and I don't know what their current situation is. But it went through a lot from the time I was there. It went through a lot of changes.
2014, you signed back on with the Wollongong Hawks, but it's kind of a different conversation. When you signed that, did you know you were going to retire? And what was that kind of conversation? What were they looking for you when they brought you back?
Yeah, well, that was tough. Any end of your career can be tough. You know, I had signed on for 2 years with the then Titans.
Yes.
So I was coming into the second year of my contract and kind of thought, you know, that might be it. But then 2 weeks before the season started, like we had 2 weeks before we were supposed to report back for workouts and stuff, they cut me.
What's that like? And they tap you on the shoulder, or they do it over the phone, or they?
Nah, they did it. It was not well done. The head coach. I don't know who was supposed to talk to me. The head coach never talked to me, though. I know that. I find out through my agent, and it was all by then. It was almost too late to then think about going to another team or anything like that. Yeah, and they don't got it. You know, they don't have to pay you out or anything like that. Okay. They have to pay you half. 50% of your contract, unless you go to another team, then they don't have to pay you anything. So I was kind of, you know, it was kind of, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow after a career full of basketball to just be like, okay, well, I'm just done and I'm going to move on, or I'm going to try and go play somewhere else. So we decided as a family to move again and go to Wollongong again to play for another year. And, you know, we moved our three kids out there. Moved house, all of our possessions out the Wollongong to play for a season, a down season, and then that was it. I was like, this is it. I'm like, I'm not moving again. This is it. So I retired from there.
I can't believe it, because I was in the UK and I moved back here. And having no kids, even I can sympathize with that. I'm like, oh man, that is a huge undertaking.
Oh yeah. If I had to do it again, I would have just retired then. But it wasn't that, you know, there was still some good experiences back in Wollongong. It was too much effort, that I know that.
What were they saying to you? Were they like, yep, we know where you're at in your career. We want you to do, you know, this and this. Were they after more of a sagely figure?
Yeah. Like, they knew where I was at. And once I got there and seeing the situation that the Hawks were in and the imports we brought in and stuff, it was like, you know, shit. Like, this isn't going to go well. And it did not go well.
Who was on that team?
It was some good guys. So half the team had been there forever with Gordy.
Yep.
And then the second half of the team was brand new. And the second half of the team, who was brand new, never quite got what we were trying to do. Like, I never understood his scheme. I never understood the plays. And the other guys on the team knew it like the back of their hand.
Right.
So it was kind of like his system. It was more like math to me than it was basketball. So I never really... By the time my career, I was like, I don't really want to be in the gym like all day long and watching film trying to figure this out. So
you just want to sort of more of a Phil Smythe type, just, you know, roll the ball out, just make the right decision. And if you don't do it right, exactly. I'm not talking to you.
Exactly.
Beautiful. Quickly going back to the Tigers. So you signed on there for 2 years, right? Or you played 2 years?
Tigers. I ended up playing for... I played for him for 2 years. Yeah, for 2 years, but I was signed on for
three.
Yeah.
And who's on that Tigers team? I've skipped over them by mistake.
It was like Chris Goulding had come from the Gold Coast Blaze.
They'd fallen, I think.
Yeah, they had. Yeah, and then Nate Tomlinson was just out of college. Mm-hmm. Lucas Walker.
A couple of guys are still
was on the. Yeah.
Was Anthony then, there at that time? Was he coaching? Or?
Yeah, he was a coach. That was his first couple years.
Was he like
coaching,
as a coach?
Yeah. He was a good coach. As far as, like, you know, he'd be the first to tell you he didn't have much experience. But as far as being a player's coach, like, I thought he wasn't bad at all. You know, for his first time around, he wasn't bad. There was good and bad, but, you know, it could have been worse.
What's the toughest thing for a first year coach, or what did Anthony struggle with? Is it like, getting your rotations down, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think all that stuff, the technical stuff, like when to call timeout, you know, what plays to run, you know, how to scout, all that kind of stuff.
All that sort of stuff, yeah.
It just takes reps. Like, it takes reps, and it takes learning from people who have done it before.
Tell me about training for the Boomers for London in 2012. You're on that training squad. Is that one of the more fierce trainings you've ever been to?
Yeah, I've been to. So I ended up going to one camp. I was at a camp, and they were going on one of their trips after that to, I think, Brazil, and as a warm up to, you know, to qualifying and all that stuff. And Brett Brown was the coach. It was a great experience, and neat. But I ended up not going on the trip because my son was going to be born. So my second, our middle child, our first son, was going to be born, and I didn't want to miss that.
Sure.
So I didn't go on the trip, and then I got another invite. Anyways, it didn't work out. So you kind of only have one chance, especially as an import or as a
naturalized,
someone who's not naturalized. That was my chance.
Yeah, that was it. You get two guys, two naturalized players can go, I believe. And that year it would have been what? Lish and I actually don't know. Do you remember who went?
No, I don't remember that team. By the time it was 2012, I think I was... I wouldn't have been up for that team, but there was teams, you know, in the middle, like all 4 years, they always choose a team.
Like the World Cup.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah, by the time 2012 came around, I think I wasn't up for anything.
Right. All right, Adam, let's quickly do a couple of quick fire things and I'll let you go. Best player you ever played against in the NBL at your position?
Anthony, by far. He's seven foot one. No, he's like 7 foot. He's huge, and he knew all the tricks. He's long, he could play in the post, he could shoot the three. He was just kind of like, you know, he can play great defense on him, but if he's going to make the shot, he's going to make the shot.
Best NBL player not at your position?
These are tough. This is a long career. I don't know. I'll go with, like, Glenn Saville. I played with him for 3 years in Wollongong, and just the amount of, you know, a lot's been said about what he could do, but he could just kind of do it all.
If nothing jumps out, you're very welcome to say pass. Most sneaky good player, like a player who you'd go, oh, no, who you kind of have to be like, no, he was really good. Maybe he had to be a player to be there, but he was sneaky good. Anyone like that?
Plenty of them. And a lot of guys don't get a chance. It's right place, right time in a lot of situations. Mm-hmm. But like Jacob Holmes, he played a long time in the league, but, he had his rebounding. You know, I think for a few years he led the league in rebounding, and he's undersized and cannot jump. Like, he can't jump over. He couldn't jump up a curb. And he led the league in rebounding for years. I think he's very underrated in that respect.
All right, I'll check it out. I remember the name. Funny or funniest teammate?
Funniest teammate. There's been a few, but remember Ben Pepper?
Sure do.
He, like, his whole life revolved around making people laugh, and he was genuinely funny. He probably still is.
What made him funny? Was he like a slapstick or like a pratfalls or witty?
All of it. He was just he was like truly a comedian. Like, he would just live to make people laugh, and he was not slapstick, but like, you know, genuine comedian.
Ben Pepper. Okay. Who was the like fiercest competitor? I'm sure you came up against a lot, but who's one who you just thought, this guy's level?
You know, I had a rivalry going with is Sean Redditch.
Okay. He was
fierce. He's another white import, naturalized import. He was at Perth. I was at Adelaide. Yeah, he started it. He cut from New Zealand, and worked his way back up and got on the right team. And he was, the perfect guy for Perth. Just a competitor and get under your skin and, like, always trying to get foul calls on him and stuff like that. But he's definitely, competitive-wise and skill-wise, he's up there.
Under your skin in what way? Because I was listening to a podcast the other day, the Trash Talk Sports Bet, Trash Talk Basketball Podcast, really good podcast. And Homicide Williams was saying that Redditch was dirty. Now, you don't have to comment on that if you don't want to. But when you say
I don't think he was dirty. I don't think he was dirty.
Just tell
But him. He was, like, ahead of his time and, like, trying to get fouls called on him. Like, he's always trying to flop and, like, take these weak charges and just get under your skin in that way. Like a soccer player, kind of.
Gotcha.
So and like James Harden, I hate that. Playing for kind of like that. Right. Oh, man, always looking for the whistle. And, if he's on your team, you love it. But if you're not on the team, man,
He just fits it. Did he talk much?
No, he never talked.
Was there anyone who did? Who was the biggest or best trash talker? Is there anyone that stands out?
Wurtho would talk quite a bit. He was always good to talk to. But, like, you know, those guys, like Homicide, he would talk all the time. I never talked much either. So I didn't get involved with it much with guys. But those guys like to talk.
Was Homicide just like a running commentary? Like, you've played against guys, I'm sure, who just are just talking the whole time. They get the inbound pass. I'm dribbling up. I'm coming down. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then they do it, and then they tell you about it. Was that kind of his style? Was he more like Adam Ballinger, I know your game, that, like, more incisive, you know what I mean?
I would say like a running commentary. That's probably a good way to put it.
Okay. Isn't it your favorite player growing up, big or small? You know, like, who was your favorite guy? Any league.
Well, growing up, you always, especially in Indiana, you look up to the guys who are playing high school basketball, but you probably wouldn't know those names. If NBA, I love the Knicks. I love the 90s Knicks. And Patrick Ewing was and still is my favorite player of all time. Him and Larry Bird, of course.
Bird, of course, being the Indiana connection, makes sense.
Yeah.
I've got a team you dislike playing the most, or even player who you dislike playing the most. We've covered that with Redditch.
Yeah, Redditch and Perth. Like, love/hate. It's like a love-hate
disliked them because you liked playing them, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, like battles. Like, you look back on that and think, man, that's what it was all about. Yeah.
I think there's that's the best part, when you hate someone so much you like playing them. Adam, I'll kind of end it there. Thanks very much for taking the time. What was I going to say? You're still watching a bit of the NBL. And just quickly, like, do you like the state of the NBL? Are you enjoying watching the product?
I love the state of it. I wish the state of it would have been a bit better when I was playing. But I think what, you know, Larry has done and taken over the league and Melbourne United, it's what's needed. I mean, they're pumping money into it, and they're also getting it out into kind of new age of, like, you know, social media and getting in front of people's faces. Yeah. You know, they're bringing in more imports, which makes it tougher for Australians to get into the league. But it's also that, you know, they want the kind of the highlights that get fans interested now in this age of, you know, social media age, where everybody's giving, you know, 3 seconds of attention to everything. But yeah, I love the state of it. I think it's, you know, they're putting out a great product.
Always good when more teams come. We've got one team coming in this year, the Phoenix, maybe more, who knows. And you've done a bit of commentary, Adam. Do you enjoy the commentary side of this stuff?
Yeah, I do enjoy it. I'd like to do some more. We'll see if I get the opportunity. Yeah, but I'd like to do more sports media, just, you know, the creative side of sports and stuff like that. I really enjoy. So I've done some of it, and I think the more I do, the better I'll get. You know, they kind of just throw you in there. I've never done it before. So I've done a few games, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more.
The thing I'm going to mention, and not that I carry any clout at all, but the thing I'm going to say is, you know how the AFL does those like premiership cartoon posters in the newspaper?
Yeah, and on the cards. On the cards.
Too. And the cards. You know what I think? I think you, Adam, or I'm going to put it out there in the universe, should do, like, when the NBL Grand Final is on, you do the sort of cartoon, you know, logo, one against the other, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I don't know why I'm not doing that yet.
That is a good question. Adam, thanks really much. I really appreciate it. And good luck with everything, okay?
Okay, thanks. Awesome to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. Ciao. Bye.
All right, take it easy.